Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and tonight we have a special program featuring the winners of the 2011 Writers' Cafe Contest, sponsored by the Writing Center of the University of Pittsburgh. With us tonight are five writers reading their winning pieces of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction. We will also talk with writer Ellen McGrath-Smith, who will talk about the Writers' Cafe and the Writing Center. So we'll begin with the poetry winner, Nina Shabak. She has won first and second place in poetry this year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Nina Shabak is a sophomore fiction major at the University of Pittsburgh, where she is also studying Russian and French. She is from Fairmont, West Virginia. So can you read some of your winning stuff?
These are four poems from a series entitled Songs for Little Russia about studying Russian in Pittsburgh. To Dance. It grew cold while I slept, and my walk is interrupted by leaves skidding across the pavement like snakeskins. Today we are learning complex sentences. You do not know where Anya was. I know where Misha lives. Yulia paces the room waiting, and Anya and Misha are waiting too, but I have forgotten how to conjugate to dance, or rather, I am dancing with you, which strikes me as the first thing you should know, except maybe the alphabet and Slava Isusu Christo. It is Monday in Pittsburgh, and no one feels like feeling except maybe the evangelists on the corner with their dog-eared brochures. Heaven awaits the willing. Please form an orderly line for the apocalypse. Come on and shake your blues out. There's nothing like a little damnation to spice up this weather. But we've gotten off topic. Yulia sighs and begins to tell a different story, something we can understand, the edges smoothed to our few words. To hell with infinitives. Sometimes it is better not to know how to say what you are doing. To Walk. Now when I walk past the Union, I see the men in their rough brown pants pulling up red geraniums, fistful over fistful, like scalps from a forgotten war. The petals have fallen off for the most part, shriveled and burgundy, like the wine that my mother forbids me to drink except at New Year's. I walk through the slanting drizzle toward the cathedral, where you can buy hot tea in a paper cup, taste the way your mouth moves. Hibiscus, lemongrass, rose hips, tarragon. If I grow up, I'll name teas after places I haven't been yet. In room 218, I wait for something to begin, the rest filing in, all those boys named after revolutionaries. Marat, Nikita, Yosef, who slouch American style, eyes half shut. And Yulia comes in and says that we should really be able to remember the prepositional case now, as in what we talk about when we talk about love. A woman outside asks if I voted for Sestak yet, and I have to say that I'm still not from here. For lunch, I have waffles and chocolate syrup, because I once wanted to have them for every meal, and I'm living the dream now. I still feel like apologizing or eating some broccoli or something. On Bigelow, someone's listening to LaRue with the bass turned up. I like LaRue when I can hear right, I decide. I don't like guessing at words. I like pre-post-avant-pop, not so much suffixes. We like those short-haired girls. I just want to be famous enough for someone to cut my hair every week so I can walk around with the wind on the back of my neck. I wonder if one person out of 311,000 is thinking about the back of my neck as I pass the extraneums in silence and walk through the dirt. Possibly so. To Breathe. It is 11:50 in Pittsburgh, a Wednesday. The first day I can see my breath. Yes, it is 2010, and I am wearing my wool coat for the first time since March, because Rachel told me to. And at the light, at 11:56, I find grocery receipts in my right pocket, and I don't know how to keep walking. I walk up Bigelow and turn past the crowds of girls in their winter tights, the boys smoking cigarettes behind their cupped hands, and no one is talking about the election. I pick up a copy of the newspaper where they have printed three articles about it and a crossword I cannot solve. I go to class and Svetlana, real name Allie, asks, "Who else plans to keep studying this bizarre language?" And I raise my hand, because I like bizarre languages and the way they feel on my tongue. I've picked up enough French to curse out a policeman, enough Russian to run a circus, or maybe just the elephants. And in Fairmont, I picked up enough English to know that I needed to pretend to be from somewhere else. You know it's all in how your vowels bend, but mine don't. I do a convincing impression of not being myself most days, which is to say that I have no opinion of what Joe Manchin does back home, or God forbid his use of hair gel. And when we start, my heart is still pounding loud enough to hear in Rostov or outer space, which is what happens when you're just a little too suggestible. Bring on the newspapers, Pittsburgh. You can't surprise me. To survive. Unit 4. Disbelief. Tell me something fantastic, Yulia says. I will show you how to react. We are learning how to lie with words we still don't understand. Everyone poised to say something unbelievable. I will be different every time. Marat is an astronaut. Irina, a lawyer. Kolia turned green overnight. Votete da, a tiaksana. Me, I'm a ballerina today. A very good ballerina. I danced at the Bolshoi on that raked stage, and the Ballet Russe adored me. We went everywhere together in our fast cars and shawls, like Isadora Duncan, a close friend of mine. So sad about that long white scarf. This I could believe, Yulia says, Pravda, and I square my shoulders to hips like Anna Pavlova about to take off into the cosmos, soundless and sweet, where it is still raining.
That was Nina Shabak reading her prize-winning poems from the Writers' Cafe contest. So you won first and second place.
Yes, I did.
That's kind of impressive.
I'm thrilled.
And you're reading from a sequence, Songs for Little Russia. Can you tell us a little bit about that sequence?
The poems are written about 1 week of studying Russian, written in the style of Frank O'Hara. So they are about each day as it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great idea. And what a great voice in those poems.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, I'm talking with the poet Ellen McGrath-Smith, who teaches writing and literature at the University of Pittsburgh and poetry for the Mad Women in the Attic. She is a founder of the Writer's Cafe, which she coordinates with fiction writer Jeff Martin. Her poems have appeared in journals such as CQ, 5 AM, Cafe, Pig Iron, The Prose Poem, Pearl, Southern Poetry Review, and the Pittsburgh Quarterly. Hi, Ellen McGrath-Smith. How you doing?
I'm good, Jan. How are you?
Oh, I'm happy because it's always great to see these young writers and all the great work they come up with through the Writer's Cafe. So thanks for doing this every year.
Well, and thank you. You've been with us since the beginning of this contest, and we really appreciate Prosody and YEP's support. It's just a great gift to the whole program to be able to have these broadcasts that people can hold on to and pass around. So thank you.
Oh, sure. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the Writer's Cafe for those of our listeners out there who don't know what it is?
Sure. 8 years ago at the Pitt Writing Center, which is an interdisciplinary site for, it's housed in the English department, but it's a site for helping Pitt graduate and undergraduate students with writing issues of all kinds across departments. Geeta Kothari, who directs the Writing Center, thought it would be a great idea for us to create a venue for creative writers as well, because most people thought of the Writing Center as a place to go for serious papers, as if creative writing isn't serious. And so we started it off thinking it was going to be mostly a workshopping kind of opportunity. We scheduled it for Friday afternoons every 2 weeks. And what we found was that people wanted to do mostly writing improv, writing jam sessions, not so much critical workshops. And that's been the model that we followed for the ensuing 8 years that we've been holding this here at Pitt. So we usually have about 14 sessions per year. We launch each semester with something a little special. Often it's a writer who's just come out with a book. This year we had Kirk Nesset in the fall. And then we had Stacey Waite and Eugene Cross in the spring semester launching things off. But we try to facilitate each session with writers from on and off the Pitt campus. And people have been really generous with volunteering their time and coming to facilitate. We have special panels sometimes. Just about a month into the spring semester, we were lucky to have six Pittsburgh area writers under 35 who came to talk about ways that you can make a literary community, ways to survive as a writer and connect to other writers after graduation, which I thought was just a great event because we had all of these writers who were doing things like running reading series, doing sound engineering for radio shows, just all of this, these voices talking about what they did as writers to keep that alive, to keep their passion going, to support other writers. So we do that kind of thing. We try to provide resources. But first and foremost, what we're doing every other Friday afternoon at Pitt during the school year is getting some writing generated in a non-judgmental, relaxed environment.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for all your work.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2011 Writers' Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. Our first place fiction winner in the Writers' Cafe contest is Liz McLaughlin. Liz McLaughlin is a part-time undergraduate fiction major at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Liz. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
Okay. So tell us what you're going to read.
I'm going to be reading an excerpt from my short story, The Cabin. When I come upon the cabin, I see the damage done. While I ran and ran through the forest, the oak tree formed a fist and punched through the floorboards. Punched straight into the root cellar. The tree is completely split now. The heavy half reaches into the floorboards like a giant hand. The sun shines hot and fierce into the cabin. I crawl through the hole ripped open by the oak, weave my way up and over the jungle gym of branches. I'm suddenly a kid again. Once inside, I see that a thick branch has crushed the wood stove. Another has smashed the rocking chair to splinters. Everything a busted game of pickup sticks, shingles, and 2x4s sprawling. I notice a gleam in the root cellar, a glint of sunlight refracted, something wedged under the floorboards. Like an exploding beam of sunlight burst into a million pieces of color, it all comes flooding back to me, wavelength by individual wavelength, the thirst. Before my brain can even register it, my body responds. See, the thirst is faster than the electrical synapses between my neurons. This time I crawl back through the branches, get underneath them to creep into the black earth of the root cellar. In the darkness, in the dirt, my hands grasp a long, tall bottle, ominous black label, glass so thick and sturdy. I can feel its contents pulsating, clear and cool and sharp and clean. I'm vibrating. The tiny hairs on my arms stand on end. A thought begins to push its way to the forefront of my consciousness. Almost immediately, this thought is pushed down, 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 and replaced by fear and joy and blood-pumping, heart-pounding justification. This is it, my temptation, my moment of reckoning. This is my talking snake. The gnarled branches of the oak form a canopy over my body as I sit in the dirt of the root cellar. My fist tightly grips the bottle of whiskey. I loosen the cap and drink down the burning brown liquid. Everything is dead quiet now, mute. The branches of the oak tree brush against me, its leaves cool and wet on my face. Row upon row of dewy brown liquid shimmers encased in glass. Enough to last me months, years. I have died. This is heaven. With my free hand, I begin to peel back the layers. I unzip my skin and slip free. It's only now that I discover it. I have no backbone, no supporting structure, nothing at my center. I'm pure exoskeletal. I collapse back into the moist black dirt below, no longer a man, now an empty suit. The branches shudder. The quaking leaves shake tiny droplets of water straight through me into the dirt below. I am a wayless. I am steam. I press the bottle into my chest and can feel it growing larger with every breath I take, an inflating balloon. I close my eyes and feel myself rising. I float through the branches, through the floorboards, through the rafters. I rise right out of the cabin, pulled by some invisible slipstream into the sky above. The evening sun pours in through the window and warms my chest. The rocking chair shifts, creaking the floorboard below it and jolting me awake. I grab at my chest in search of the bottle. There is no bottle. I survey the room and it is solid, each plank in place. I jump out of the chair. My body creaks like the floorboards, stiff with sleep. I run outside. The oak tree sways in the light breeze. Its leaves make a rustling, swishing sound. The blood in my ears makes a rustling, swishing sound. Relief floods into me with the final few rays on the horizon. I am illuminated. I am strong and fierce and golden in the setting sun. But I am still vibrating. My muscles twitch, my reflex to sprint. To run, deeper into the woods, deeper every day. But I don't. I fill my chest with air. I quiet my cocked muscles, take the pressure off the trigger. I forget the tree, the trail. I return to the cabin as the sun slides under the horizon. I make a small fire to heat soup. Outside, the branches of the oak tree clamber toward the night sky, steady and strong. Its roots dig deep into the black earth. The cabin shivers.
That was Liz McLaughlin, and she is the first place fiction winner in the Writers' Cafe contest. But I really liked your images. What's that one thing you said? No longer a man, now an empty suit.
Yeah, thanks.
That was great.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next we'll hear from second place fiction winner Noah Levinson. Noah Levinson is from Scranton, PA. He is majoring in fiction writing and film studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Noah. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Okay, so what is the name of your piece?
I called it Chess, and I'm going to read a few excerpts from it.
Okay.
It's about a postman who finds his big chest, and he takes it from his ex-wife's house back to his own while she's away. So, my house was the fourth on the left, the one with the clown mailbox, and the clown lawn ornament, and the clown welcome mat. Then inside, I had a bookshelf of all this clown stuff, foam noses, seltzer bottles, rubber chickens, stuffed rabbits. On some shelves, I had books. Be a Clown, The Complete Guide to Instant Clowning by Turk Pipkin. Clown Magic by David Jin, and Quit Clowning Around 300 Ways to Solidify Your Clown Career, my favorite. Below the books on the bottom shelf, I kept some old videotapes of my favorite clowns, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Larry Moe, Curly, not Shemp, and definitely not Curly Joe. I also had a few tapes marked up with Sharpie, Cousin's Birthday, 66, Helen's Wedding, 75, sample for interested clients. I kept them on the bottom shelf because I didn't have a VHS player anymore. I upgraded to a DVD player. The thing is, I don't have any DVDs. There wasn't any good space for the chest I was still cradling in my arms, so I took it upstairs to my bedroom. Many wouldn't even notice that between all the paintings of clowns, Bozo and Pagliacci, on the walls there was one little framed photograph of a happy young couple wearing matching white sweatshirts. His red, I'm with Alice. Hers red, I'm with David. Gruffing and harumphing at this point, my arms quivering, and something in my throat about to explode, maybe a vein, I let the chest slip out of my slippery hands and fell to the ground with a soft cry. My left eye twitched, and I harumphed myself onto the bed. There's a giant mirror behind it. I wondered what the people that lived here before me used it for. Such strange placement for such a large mirror. I forced a smile to my reflection. Alice said my smile was my best attribute. You always laugh and say, I'll never do that, just like plucking nose hairs and shaving moles. Eventually, though, you're just there one day, combing over four or five depressing strands of gray hair on your scaly, freckly scalp, and wondering what you did with your life. Regardless, I woke up every morning and lied to myself to boost my self-esteem. You're awesome, I told me. My spine started aching again, so I opened my dresser drawer with the clown face handle that was difficult to grab, because if you did it wrong, you'd cut yourself on his teeth. There were two of these cold pads left. They're great. You just squeeze them and they get super cold. They feel fantastic on my calves, and sometimes if no one's looking and if I'm alone, they feel good on my rear. Like Christmas came early, for my buttocks. I wrapped the pad around my calf. I hadn't shut my curtain, so I was afraid to stick it down my backside. And then I heard it, like a muffled squeak. Meep. I missed Alice. I heard it again. Meep. Meep. I tripped and smacked my head in surprise against the clown-faced dresser drawer. A narrow canyon opened in the flesh on top of my head. Small blood droplets fell into the carpet. Alice hated blood. She wasn't afraid of it, she just irrationally hated it. I think she thought it was a sign of weakness. Maybe knowing that our bodies were full of this thick red juice secretly scared her. But whenever someone picked their nose too hard or scratched open a scab or bit a potato chip the wrong way, Alice would stick up her nose, huff twice, and leave the room. I loved that she hated blood. There's her picture on the wall. She's so pretty, golden hair, small smile, soft neck. Her grandfather was a Nazi, and her father a sports reporter in Cleveland who died in a freak boating accident in the Arizona desert. She majored in economics and biology. We met in Introduction to French Bourgeois. I asked her if she liked clowns. She said not in particular. Meepy, 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 shut up, I said. I could feel the words push past my throat and vomit out of my mouth. The meeping stopped. I uncovered my ears. A little bit of blood on each palm. Oh my God, just shut up! Okay, said the chest. Sorry. That's okay, I said. I suppose you should explain yourself, though. Well, what happened to Alice? You won't stop thinking about her, said the chest. She left me. You know, I tried doing clowning seriously as a career, and she couldn't handle city life. It was only a couple years, okay, not even a decade. Too many late nights, birthday parties, not enough money. She wouldn't wait any longer. Sorry, it said again. It's kind of sad. The silence hung stale in the air. Do you have any idea, I said, how hard it was to find work after John Wayne Gacy Jr.? I mean, he really screwed all his clowns over. I could imagine. Why are you screaming anyway? It's annoying. Oh, there's a lot of pain inside me that I want to get out, but I don't know how. Can I help you? Sure, but it won't be pleasant. Is anything anymore? Well, what about fishing? Fishing seems pretty pleasant. That's true. I sighed and clasped my hands together. Oddly, the chest seemed to have gotten larger in the last few minutes. Before I went to open the latch on the front, I had to be sure of one thing, though. Wait. You aren't going to take me on some sort of miserable, traumatizing, fantastic dream sequence where you go into my head, take my fears, and make them visibly concrete? That silence sure was stale. Nope.
Okay, that was Noah Levinson reading from his second-place fiction piece entitled Chest, with sound effects, right? That was great. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2011 Writers Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. Our next reader is the first-place winner in creative nonfiction, Joshua M. Patton. Joshua M. Patton is a father and Army veteran. He's a sophomore in creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Josh. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Hello.
Great. And what are you going to be reading?
I'm going to be reading an excerpt from my essay, Gunzo, The Thrill of Fear and Fear of the Thrill.
Okay, great.
April took a deep breath and then raised her Beretta 9mm handgun. In front of her, she saw a scruffy man in a green shirt with his left hand around the throat of a 9-year-old boy. In his right hand, the man held a gun to the boy's temple. The boy's eyes were closed, his expression plain. She opened fire. She fired again and again until her magazine was empty, the barrel back and the bullet chamber exposed. She pulled the trigger a few times, and when nothing happened, she tipped it backwards to stare down the barrel. "Jesus Christ!" yelled Steve, her boyfriend. "You do not ever point the gun barrel anywhere other than downrange!" He gestured toward her lane of the indoor shooting range, the realistic photo target still swaying slightly from being peppered with bullets. Almost all of her rounds were through the large belly of the man in the picture, but an errant round had punctured the cheek of the little boy. All in all, for her first time shooting a weapon, it was impressive. She could improve with just a little training and practice. But April couldn't get past the image of the boy with the hole in his cheek. We had all selected the target for the ridiculous depiction of something so horrid. A child held at gunpoint. Steve tried to explain to her how we chose it ironically and that she was overreacting. But the first time feeling the cold steel of the gun, the added weight of a fully loaded magazine, and the inimitable power that comes from sending hot lead downrange is a powerful, unforgettable feeling. Her emotions were amplified by the experience. I switched Steve's photorealistic target to one with four bullseyes in each corner. I shot and reloaded, shot and reloaded. The ritual was part of that feeling of safety. Raise the weapon. Breathe. Relax. Aim. Squeeze. A round jammed in the chamber. I flicked on the safety with my thumb, cleared the round, and then the cycle began again. All too soon, my box of 50 bullets was empty, but the ritual continued. I broke down the weapon, ensuring it was free of ammunition. I cleaned the lane of empty boxes and brass casings, which I swept to the floor with my hand. I brought in the target, examining my accuracy. I glanced through the window. Steve and April had vacated the range. April had wanted a cigarette to calm her nerves. I imagined she stood in the late autumn heat, the cigarette trembling between slender fingers that had only just killed a paper boy. I looked around for the push broom used to sweep the walkway clear of the brass casings of spent rounds, observing good range etiquette. I swept away my brass casings and exited through the door to the area where guns were rented and ammunition was sold. I surveyed those still in the range and those milling about in this area. They were just folks, normal people that happened to have in their possession a death-dealing instant terror machine. With a 15-round magazine in the Beretta, a vision of the bedlam I could cause gripped me. I could end the old man behind the counter before he could reach his loaded sidearm hanging from his belt. Then I would turn the weapon on the two randoms at the table nearby, breaking down and cleaning their personal weapons. The ones in the range would be a challenge, since most of their weapons were locked and loaded. Still, there was only one door, and I had the advantage of cover. They were in their lanes like animals in stalls, waiting for the slaughter. They sent their rounds downrange at paper targets instead of noticing the crazed gun enthusiast sneaking up behind them. Also, the range was soundproof, so unless one of them happened to turn around or look outside, they wouldn't even know what was happening until it was too late. I noticed the old man behind the counter eyeing me with an odd look on his face. Perhaps he had seen the look in my eyes before? I wondered if he was mapping out in his mind how he would take me out if I were to snap an open fire. Jesus, does everyone who knows guns think this way? I approached the counter and returned the empty handgun, making harmless small talk with the man I had mentally shot through the forehead only seconds before. Now he was the only one with a weapon, and I felt the familiar sense of anxiety that comes from being unarmed in a room full of guns. Maybe my fear and the fears of the other gun enthusiasts are not so different. We intimately know that once a gun is in someone's hand, he or she is only an impulse away from madness, mayhem, and murder.
That was Joshua M. Patton, first place winner in creative nonfiction. I really like the sense of the real in that piece.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so we have one more reader. We have second place winner in creative nonfiction, Mary Seiko. Mary Seiko was from Export, Pennsylvania, and is a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh, majoring in fiction. Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
Okay, so what are you reading tonight?
I'm reading an excerpt from my piece, The Thistle.
Okay.
When the thistle lived underwater, he didn't have any thorns. He grew from the silty floor, whole and spherical, watching the ripples float above him like a lace tablecloth. At first he thought, as all thistles did, that he must be an egg. He waited and waited to hatch, waited to know what he would finally become. He saw his thistle mother and his thistle father grow and wither and die, swept off by some current or another, without ever hatching, without anything ever emerging from their round heads so perfect for the growth of the strange and the ornate. But the thistle knew this would not happen to him, trusted it with all his heart. Nice heads like his just were not wasted. So he waited and did what his thistle brain told him his thistle parents might have wanted, and he started to grow old. One morning, looking at his thistle brother and his thistle sister and their perfect egg heads, just as round as his was, he knew he wasn't going to hatch. He'd never known anyone who had. The author is surprised and pleased with the thistle for figuring that one out. A lot of people never do. In the morning, the thistle pulled himself up out of the ground, putting his egg head on the floor and yanking his thistle stem from the sand. His brother and his sister screamed their thistle screams, awful rattling screams like train whistles without the soul, telling him to stay put because didn't he know he was lucky to be a thistle in such a nice part of town? Didn't he know that being a thistle is pretty damn cushy and not something you throw away? But the thistle didn't know this, and he never had, so he inched across the floor, his stem curling then extending in front of him, his big head sagging useless behind and leaving the trail of a snake. He curled and extended for as long as he could stand, but it got to be too much. When he was out past his thistle brother and his thistle sister in a dark place where the fish looked strange and the coral moved in odd ways, sweeping across his face like cobwebs and laughing as it did, he stopped. He rested and he thought about giving up, about rerooting and twisting his stem back into the ground and making do with the fact that he'd tried. The thistle rested for a while and got to know the neighboring thistles and the fish who passed through the town and even got a nickname, Columbus, since he'd come from so far away. And he got so comfortable he thought he could actually be happy in this new place. In some ways, the author thinks the thistle has it easier than she herself. Judging by the author's continued use of the masculine pronoun, it would appear that the thistle is of the male persuasion. What a boon. Have penis, will travel. Being born a girl was the greatest trick ever played on the author. Girls do not travel alone. They might be murdered. Girls do not talk to strangers. They might be raped. Girls do not throw themselves fully into art and eccentricity until their lives are beautiful microcosms of all that is great and strange and terrible, balanced delicately on the ledge above the twists of chaos, feeling that wind that comes from the collision of air pressures whip their hair in front of their faces. They wouldn't make very good mothers then, would they? The second greatest trick ever played on the author was not being born beautiful. If a girl's to do something strange and adventurous, she'd damn better do it while looking pretty. If she's to become a mess, she'd better become a hot one. Isn't Sissy Hankshaw, after all, beautiful? Doesn't she look just like Princess Grace, jumpsuits and thumbs and all? Aren't the cowgirls all curves and cinched waists beneath their costumes? A plain girl, though, she's not supposed to act out, be bold. She's not supposed to exist, frankly, but since she does, she should take up as little space as possible. She should say excuse me when she bumps into men and diet herself into nothing and squeeze against the walls of the bus and the restaurant to make room for everybody else. No girl should be an adventurer, but a plain girl simply can't.
That is the work of Mary Seiko, a second place winner in creative nonfiction. Boy, that took a turn from the thistles to the very intense ideas. That was great.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I will thank both of you for being here. This has been the writing of the winners of the 2011 Writers' Cafe Contest, sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Writing Center. Thanks so much to everyone for being here. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.